present are Senator Giesel, Senator Wilkowski, and Senator Dunleavy is on the phone. Can you hear us, Mike?
Yes, I can, Senator.
All right. I don't know yet. Oh, there's Senator Olson has joined us. So,
Mr. Chairman,
we did send an invitation to some members of the House on State Affairs and Labor Commerce. I don't know if they will show up or not. Senators Coghill, Michiki, Ellis, and Stedman have been excused, and I don't see any other legislators here. I see lots of old friends. Purpose is to get an informational meeting on the bargaining unit labor agreements, and we're looking at 5 public unions, that contracts that will be negotiated this year, including the 3 maritime unions, Avtec teachers, and public safety employees. I'll be hearing from Deputy Commissioner Chris Thayer and Deputy Director Kate Sheehan, right? All right, both of the Department of Administration. This is an informational meeting only, and when we get later on in the process, I think we'll have a look, be able to have a look at the contracts and so on with Deputy Commissioner Thayer's agreement. We're going to allow questions all during the process, and so all I know to say, Commissioner Thayer.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. And as previously said, I have Deputy Director Kate Sheehan with me, and she does labor relations for the state. And behind us is our lifeline, who's retiring soon, Nikki Neal, as the Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations.
Please, if you have your cell phones, put them on ringer off, so that we don't have any embarrassing interruptions. Please continue.
This morning, what we did similar to last year, and what we want to do this morning, is we're going into negotiations with 5 public employee unions. It's kind of bargaining one-on-one in a sense of some of the issues the state has looked at and issues that we will be bringing forth to the unions at the bargaining table. It's not everything. We don't hope to bargain here. That's not the goal here. Our goal here is just to kind of lay out some of our priorities. So they're very open and transparent. And as we talk about these contracts, there's things in these contracts that are legacy issues, and by no means do we mean be critical of contracts that were negotiated in the past. They were negotiated, they were agreed to, the legislature passed the monetary terms, and they're valid contracts. But as we move forward, there's some issues that I think that you'll see that we bring up, where there's some corrective action that I think on behalf of the state we would like to make. But again, we'll be negotiating those in December. But with that, negotiations are mandated by the Public Employment Relations Act. Bargaining is in accordance with the terms set forth in the collective bargaining agreements, and they commence usually in October. We've had some scheduling issues, and we're starting majority of them in December, and December and January we have dates lined out. The state must negotiate and enter into written agreements on matters of wages, hours, other terms and conditions of the employment, and they are considered mandatory subjects for bargaining. For example, if we were cost of living, merit increases, pay increments, leave accrual, health insurance, those are all mandatory. The state may but is not required to negotiate what we call permissive subjects of bargaining, classifications, benefits for retirees, representation of non-permanent employees. These monetary terms must be submitted to the legislature no later than the 60th day of the legislative session. So we will begin negotiations, and we are to have a document for the legislative consideration by about March 18th. We met that goal last year with those 3 unions. That is our goal this year, is to give the legislature the full 30 days to review these contracts.
Mr. Thayer, is it appropriate for it to be public at any time during the process, appropriate for this committee or whatever, to know what are the issues that you're wrestling with?
Traditionally, the legislature has not done that. They have, when we come in with the monetary terms, but actually what's at the negotiating table, the legislature doesn't normally, they have the monetary terms, but not necessarily the issues as it accounts for if we're negotiating different items of, you know, personnel and classifications and those type of things.
All right. So in the list of things that you said are to be negotiated, I didn't hear working conditions and working environment. Would you comment on that?
That has traditionally not been a subject of negotiations. It's been management's prerogative in doing that.
Yeah,
and that goes back 30 plus years.
Yeah, please continue.
Okay. If negotiations do not lead to an agreement and mediation fails, employees except the protective service like public safety have the right to strike. Employees who strike do not get paid but are not terminated because they choose a lawful strike. Striking employees may be replaced either temporarily or for the duration of the strike or permanently under certain circumstances. But our goal is to reach a fair and balanced agreement. Contracts are 3 years in duration, not longer. They can be shorter if we choose to do a 1 year, 2 year, but a maximum is 3 years, and traditionally we try to do the 3 years. And typically bargaining by the state is a cycle of 3 to 5 agreements each year. That's the reason we like the 3 years is we are negotiating multiple. I did 3 last year. We're doing 5 this year. We have more next year, so if we change that schedule, it 1 year could get rather cramped with our staffing. With striking, it is in statute, and there's 3 strike classes, 1, 2, and 3. The first class is mainly police, fire, protective services, jail, prison, correctional officers. These employees may not strike. The class 2 is composed of public utility, snow removal, sanitation, educational institution employees, state boarding school, and the Alaska Marine Highway System. So they would be in strike 2. These employees may strike after mediation, subject to a vote requiring a majority vote by secret ballot. The strike may only last for a limited time, which is determined by the interests of health, safety, and welfare of the public. And then what you have is you have strike 3. The class is composed of public employees who are not in classes 1 and 2. All the contracts that we are bargaining this year fall into class 1 and 2. Public safety class 1, ABTAC, and the Marine Highway would fall into strike class 2 this year. By bargaining unit, what we have is these are the multiple contracts that we negotiate. Up for 2014, is the Alaska Vocational Technical Teachers Association. There's 41 employees. We have the Inman Union of the Pacific, which is 669. It's clearly the largest this year. We have the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, which is 107. The Master Mates are 98. And then the Public Safety Employees Association is 509.
Excuse me. I assume that's the troopers?
And, yes.
And some of the village public safety officers?
No, Mr. Chair, it's actually the troopers, and it's airport police and fire officers. Village public safety officers are not unionized.
Yeah, okay.
So those are the 5 contracts. And in comparison, if you look at the bottom of the slide, the contracts that we negotiated last year represented about 11,000 employees. But those were just three unions. So this year we have more agreements, but the volume of employees literally is about 1,500 total. The average yearly base salary, to kind of put it in comparison, is, and we did it in the order in which the union would negotiation, and that is ABTAC. The teachers are averagely paid about $76,000 a year. Inman Union of the Pacific, it's about $51,000. The Marine Engineers, about $73,000, and Master Mates and Pilots, about $85,000. And then the troopers are split into 2. The AA stands for the troopers. Their average pay is about $84,000, and the airport police and fire officers are about $70,000. So there's a little bit of a split there. But in comparison, we find that the two the most highly compensated happen to be 3 of the ones we're negotiating this year. When we look a little bit further,
yes, sir.
What I'd like to have is a little bit of an idea of what the spread is. I've keyed on the word you said, average. So let's take the Marine Masters and Pilots. Can you give me an idea what, or us an idea what the starting salary is and then what your highest wage earner you want? Just rough numbers.
We have the highest a little bit later in the slide packet, but I'm not sure what the beginning compensation. We'll get that information for you, the starting salary.
If we had total personnel costs for a position, what would that add to these, 30-40%? The cost of,
We have that a little bit later in a graph broken out.
As usual, ahead of me, Senator Easel has the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Masters, Mates, and Pilots, how many of those folks are Alaska residents?
We have that in a slide pack, but I believe it's about 90% of that group.
Thank you.
With the contracts, a little bit about each bargaining unit. We discussed with the AVTAC bargaining unit, there's 41 members. Their average age is 51, with the average years of service of about 8 years to the state. Their average monthly pay is about $6,300 a month, which gives them that $75,800 average yearly salary. The total gross pay for all members, and this includes premium pays, but excludes benefits, and benefits run about 49% of what you see for a cost, but the cost is about $3 million in wages for those people. When we look at the Inman Union of the Pacific, they have 669 members. Their average age is 47. They've worked for the state a little less than 7 years. Their average pay is lower at $4,300. 10% of those members reside out of state. So 90% are Alaska residents within Inland Boat Union. And, again, excluding benefits, their total gross pay is about $33 million, $34 million to the state.
Are these generally what I would call deckhands? But it's also people that do the food service and make up the staterooms and all
that
stuff?
Correct. Yeah, through the chair, Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. Those would be the deckhands, handling the lines on the vessels, cooks, that would all fall into that class.
I understand that they have to be Coast Guard certified on some level against the day that there's an emergency, and they have to be counted on to do all kinds of other classic mariner tasks.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
The next one we have is the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association. There's 107 bargaining members, of which 38% do not reside in Alaska. They're not Alaska residents. Only 62% of that workforce is. The average age is a little bit older at 47, with about 6 years of service. Again, average monthly pay about $6,100, with their average yearly pay close to a little over $73,000. The gross pay for these are about $10 million to the state, these 107 employees.
Senator Wilkowski, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any way we can increase the number of in-state residents? I mean, is there just a lack of Alaskan residents for these jobs?
That's an issue that I think we struggle with. We would obviously like to see more Alaskans in this position. There is something that we have called COLD, Cost of Living Differential, which we'll be addressing shortly, that was in place back in 1977 to help address this by paying the people that live in Alaska more. But this particular bargaining unit does have a majority out of state, and that is a concern.
And I assume those, obviously they commute to work somewhere or another, get to their home port to get on the ship.
Correct. They're responsible for providing transportation to their home port.
Sure. And then what's the amount of time they're on board as opposed to the time they're off?
Mr. Chair, their normal schedule is 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. On some vessels, marine engineers were 28 days straight.
Sure. All right. And think some of our vessels go down to Seattle, and I suspect that some of the folks that are living out of state are serving those vessels. Is that at all true?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's true. It goes down to Bellingham. Bellingham is not a change port, and so they would need to get to wherever their change port is, and they can fly on their own. Sometimes they can deadhead on the vessel and take the vessel on their free time up to their change port. Most of them, I mean, they can live all over the United States as long as they get to wherever their bid job is.
All right. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
These are good-paying jobs. Is there training? Is there something that we need to work with the university maybe to try to get better-trained Alaskans so that we can start filling in these jobs with Alaskans? Have you identified, or I guess maybe that's something to look forward to in the future to fix the problem?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, this is going to be a subject that we're going to bring up at the bargaining table. To have 38% of a union living out of the state in which they work is going to be a conversation with the union.
And just from my own personal experience, Senator Wilkowski, there are private schools here that are conducted to meet all the requirements of the Coast Guard and so on. And I don't know, I just think about whether it requires more training, but the certifications can be gotten through the private sector, and the Coast Guard here administers tests fairly continually around the calendar.
When we look at the master mates and pilots, they have a membership of about 98 members. They're actually fairly young, 44 years old, for being a master of a vessel. And their average years of service is 11 years, so they tend to stay with it. They're highly compensated, about $7,000 a month, $85,000 a year. Their total gross pay for this, and again, it excludes benefits, is a little over $11 million. And with this particular union, you have 19% of their union membership reside outside the state of Alaska. Those are some numbers that we pulled that, quite frankly, when we looked at them, when you have 10%, 19%, and 38% respectively, it drew our attention to that same issue.
Reflecting, I think, Senator Wilkowski's interest, as I understand, federal law cannot discriminate against employees that don't live here. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. You are correct.
Yeah, thank you.
When we look at the Public Safety Employees Association, it's a little bit of a confusing slide because of the way that we have troopers and airport police and fire. But with the total bargaining, there's about 201 troopers, 78 airport police and fire. Their average age is 42 and 37. So, again, fairly young. Average years of service, 9 years and almost 8 years, respectively. Obviously, the state troopers average is about $7,000 a month, $5,800 for airport police, which gives us the annual payment of our annual salary of $84,000, $600,000, and $70,000, respectively. And the gross pay for those members are $42,000 and $6 million. And in here, we have a little bit further, we'll kind of discuss some of the issues around some of the pay with troopers, because there's a few that are, one of the most highly compensated state employees is one state trooper at $202,000. But we can explain why, and we will.
Senator Wilkowski.
And, yeah, maybe I'm jumping ahead here as well, but how do the staffing levels at in the troopers and at the airport, are they where they should be, or is it a situation where you have a lot, where you're understaffed and you have troopers who are forced to work a lot of overtime, which is causing the salaries to bump up? How would you explain, or can you explain what that situation is?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I think that is probably going to be a discussion for the bargaining, because I'm assuming the state, we have a position on our belief. And obviously, I think the union's going to have a different position maybe on what staffing level should be, so we'll kind of reserve that for the bargaining table. However, in some of these areas, like I made a reference to the trooper at $202,000. He's in Dutch Harbor, it's sea duty, very easily understandable, and it's the type of work that he does and the amount of time that he's on at, on sea duty that has that salary. It's not necessarily overtime, it is a set salary into that.
Senator Wilkowski, do you know what the average overtime levels are for these troopers? Do you have any sense? Is there
Through the chair, we will get that information for you. We tend to have more overtime in rural Alaska as those troopers go between villages and things, but we'll get that information for you.
Senator Kiesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thayer, how does the $84,000 for the state troopers compare to, say, the Anchorage Police Department or the Soldotna Police Department? Do you know how those wages compare?
Through the chair, I don't right offhand. I believe I don't want to speculate. I was involved on the Public Safety Committee with the Anchorage Police Department, so I have an idea. But I, let me get those numbers for you. I have a speculation that but I don't know. In Kenai, I have no idea on.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My district does include a large rural area, basically the north half of the Kenai Peninsula, and having spoken to that commander, he has trouble filling the positions because of the wage disparity. So it is a concern. I know many positions are unfilled in that that area. So thanks very much for checking into that.
Commissioner, as I understand it, and my knowledge is old, but by and large, the assignments, both in the Marine Highway System and with the troopers, is based on seniority, as is the access to the overtime hours. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, you are correct.
And I understand in the Marine Highway, because of that, some of the most experienced vessel masters have chosen a couple of the easiest routes in Southeast rather than make the run of the testy out to Dutch in the wintertime. And so we have the situation where the place where we need the most experienced, we don't have it. That doesn't mean that the guys that are running the boats out there are not competent, but comment on that, please.
Mr. Chair, you are correct. With the seniority system, as members are able to bid on certain jobs, they do bid on jobs that are beneficial to them and possibly where their families where they're at. But you are correct as far as the bidding of the jobs.
And in other jurisdictions around the country, is there any pattern of folks or unions and administration coming to some other arrangement that is satisfactory?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we have looked at and we're continuing to look at is the state of Washington. The state of Washington about 3 years ago basically took their marine highway system and dumped it upside down and completely redid it. They had several issues. Luckily, some of the issues that they had for excess pay, and they actually had a series called Waste on the Water, which was a whole series that was done on that marine highway system. Luckily, we don't have some of the issues that they were dealing with, which was considered waste. The governor was involved. There was legislation involved. But we have kind of looked to see how we kind of mirror some of those activities, and maybe and hopefully through the bargaining, we can benefit from some of the changes they made. And they were made in consultation with the union as well as management. So those are some of the things that we're looking at as we go into this. We are looking at other jurisdictions and what they've done recently. But Washington State is the most recent. And that actually was done under a Democratic governor with a Democratic legislature with the unions. And they had success in kind of, I guess, moving some mountains of historical practices.
And as I remember, the man who's in charge down there used to be involved in our ferry system, and if I've got my facts straight, he also did a stint in British Columbia. So if I'm right, he's a person with a lot of experience.
Mr. Chair, I think you are correct. I think I read that they had to have an Alaska connection. I just wasn't sure. Recall, but yes.
Yeah, I've talked to him a few times on the phone. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. there's been a lot of talk over the years about geodifferential. Do you have a sense of whether or not the geodifferential as it's currently being used is working, not working? Do you foresee changes?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that is going to be a topic that we're going to have with what we'd like to bring up at the bargaining table. We referenced it here in the presentation with the coal, the cost of living differential. That was established in 1977. A lot of things have changed since 1977, and with that, we have also had recent geodiff studies that we have implemented in other bargaining units. Just last year, we were negotiating. Last year, the exempt employees, the legislature passed a bill to apply those to the exempt class too. In some areas of the state, they saw an increase. Some areas of the state, they saw a decrease. But that is something, that study is something we want to talk about at the bargaining table because, again, what was established in 1977 doesn't hold true today. And it is a subject to mandatory bargaining.
Please continue.
You know, as we negotiate these contracts, expenses versus revenue, this is one of the areas of concern for us. We have worked with the Department of Transportation, not only with the presentation, but obviously they'll be at the table with the Department of Administration bargaining. But a couple of trends, and you can read into this as you like, but the total expenditures of the Marine Highway System is approaching $150 million a year. The personal services is running roughly $80 million of that cost, roughly half. And the total revenue that we're doing is we're bumping along around $40 to $45 million. So the long and short of it is we're going to anticipate the Marine Highway will be subsidized by the state of Alaska to the tune of over $100 million. And when we look at that being 10 years, that's $1 billion that the state is putting into the Marine Highway System. And quite frankly, we don't see it being sustainable. The state to be able to put that type of money. So one of the things is the administration has taken an approach with day boats instead of overnight. And then also, you know, one of the largest components is the salaries. Now, we're not asking that the union make huge concessions that's going to right this. It's a fundamental issue that the DOT and the Marine Highway System is continuing to work at. But it is an area that we need to look at lowering costs and figuring out if there's a more efficient way of doing marine operations. So if you look in here and we can, you know, there's different ways that we believe there's savings to be found. I think that's our goal is because when you look at this model, we just can't afford to lose $1 billion a decade. And especially when we know where it went.
Two things for the committee's benefit. A study was done here three years ago, a consultant was asked to look at our Marines Highway System and the costs and so on and so forth. And to my delight, the Department of Transportation is looking at that quite seriously, and that's a recent thing. It's only happened in the last year or so, and I'm encouraged about it. They are looking at all the issues. The other thing that was interesting to me, I had a discussion with this subsidy and this service with the governor a couple years ago, and he said, don't look at it in isolation. Look at what we spend on transportation all over the state. And the implied argument was we are subsidizing transportation with roads, airports, traffic control, all those things over the state. And so it's not just in Southeast that the state is subsidizing. I asked for and have got a study that shows the amount that is spent on transportation per citizen around the state. And it is very disproportionate to the ferry system in Southeast. And maybe I can get that information for the committee, but that was
silly. Mr. Chairman, if I can comment on that. I was looking for that information, actually. Nikki has it, but I'll talk to it as we go. We have that same information. We'll be able to provide it to the committee. But roughly what it was is per capita for the people, for the investment that we use in our highway systems, per capita, it was about $45 a person is what the state spent. Oh, here it is right here. We had the highways. There were 674,000 primary users. The cost, net cost of the state is about $28 million. So the cost per capita was $42 is what we spent. When you look at rural aviation, that was about 207,000 primary users. The net cost was about $43 million, and the cost per capita was $166. When you look at the marine highway system, you have about $107,000 users. The net cost to the state is $118 million, and so the cost per capita to marine the highway system is $1,100 per capita. So clearly, and we can provide, we'll provide this information for you in this study, but those were the numbers. But when you look at highways at $42 versus the marine highway at $1,100, there needs to be a balance there.
Would it be appropriate to know that for the railroad? It's really not analogous, is it?
Mr. Chair, I think with the railroad it's a little harder because they do more passenger service tourism in the summertime as opposed to actually moving residents. Now, of course, obviously, tourism uses our highways and our aviation and our marine highway system, but these are the three major areas that we transport our residents, and the train is not necessarily one of them.
But I assume that when you talk about the total number of passengers on the ferry, you're not differentiating between tourists and citizens.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Let's see. There was Senator Olson. You had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at these numbers, they're obviously very impressive. The big spread between the road system, the aviation system, and the highway system. But it's my understanding that there was some question as to the validity of the numbers that are there. And I was wondering, has there been an independent study to see if those numbers are valid, or somebody else that has another study that would go ahead and give their stamp of approval on it? Do you know that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, these were numbers that were done through the university through ICER. So I don't. I can present the numbers as ICER did in their study. I don't know the validity behind them or the methodology in which they chose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Going back to this chart, you had mentioned a spread of, I think, $1 billion over 10 years, and that not being sustainable. Do you have a sense of what your target would be? I mean, what would be a sustainable amount? What would be something that we need to bend the curve to get to, in your opinion?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that really is a decision for the governor and the legislature to make, what is sustainable based on budget outlays. But what we have here is we have a three-year cycle. We'll be negotiating with these three unions. Personnel costs are one of the highest drivers, and so we would hope that we can have a conversation at the bargaining table with the unions, because, again, there's not an individual fix to everything. There could be scheduling is an issue, the type of boats that we're running and the operational. The fast ferries use 600 gallons of fuel an hour. A 4.5-hour ride to Sitka is, you're looking at 2,600 gallons of fuel. And when I rode the ferry to Sitka, we had 14 people on board, and we paid $42 a person. I don't think they made money on that run that day. So there's issues there. We obviously have the salary component, or I should say the negotiations with the union is a component, not just salary, but the overall negotiation, and the type of vessels we use, the type of, and the way the vessels are operated.
It's really an inappropriate question for you, but I'd be interested in how much the total cost is fuel and what the cost of fuel was before prices went up, less than a decade ago.
Mr. Chair, we can get that information for you. One of the things that we wanted to do in our presentation here is you use the year 2005 forward, and the reason being is that takes into account the fast ferries, which is the latest vessels that we've added to the ferry system. And so obviously, their total cost for fuel and other things did that. We wanted to be more of a apples-to-apples comparison than throw an orange in there and have a previous year when we didn't have vessels that had a very high operating cost.
That's very legitimate. Thank you. Please continue.
With monetary terms, some examples of monetary terms in the state collective bargaining that we'll be looking at is the cost of living differential. told, the collective bargaining agreements are in accordance with state statutes, require a cost of living differential for a Marine Highway vessel employees residing in Alaska. Employees either receive a lump sum payment each pay period, or it is built into their hourly rate. Masters and mates and the engineers, it's a lump sum, roughly $500 to $600 per pay period they have for living in Alaska. And again, for the M and boatmen, it's an hourly wage. Travel pay is another one that we want to look at. Pay for time spent traveling outside of work hours to temporary work assignments. We also have non-watch pay, which is paid in lieu of certain overtime entitlements to higher level employees. So those are just some of those areas that go in the monetary terms.
Could you explain the last one, please?
What's that?
The non-watch pay.
For the record, this is Kate Sheehan. I apologize for not identifying myself earlier. Non-watch pay is a type of pay that is paid to master's mates and pilots, and it's in lieu of overtime, except on the fast ferries, it's actually you can get non-watch pay and overtime, and so it's built into their hourly rate of pay. I believe some engineers also receive non-watch pay, and so it's just another type of premium pay.
And does that mean when they're on the boat but not working? They're kind of on standby?
Well, through the chair, it's also while they're working in some cases. It depends on the vessel. But it's supposed to be, I'm looking at my notes here. It's paid in lieu of, like, a daily overtime, for instance, and so if you work additional hours.
Oh, okay. And did I hear you say that they, under some circumstance, they get both overtime and non-watch pay?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did. At the fast ferries, they receive overtime and non-watch pay.
What's the justification for that?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to go back and look at the bargaining notes to see the intent at the time that was negotiated.
Okay, thank you.
For the record, she's also an attorney, so she gives us very... one thing, monetary terms. Now, by no means have we had a decision on what our monetary terms would look like to the union. We are in receipt of the letter from last year from leadership, where they had indicated the wages would be 000 was the preference of the legislature. But for the sake of this presentation, we wanted to just say, what would a 1% increase look like? So it was an arbitrary number we have picked. It's not something that that's on the table with the unions. But in FY 2015 with M and Boatman's Union, it's about $500,000. And over 3 years, it could be worth as high as $5 million because you have the cumulative effect on it. The Marine Engineers Association would be $156,000 a year, but over 3 years, it's almost $1.6 million. There is a typo here, and I do apologize. The Master Mates and Pilots FY 2015, it's actually $166,000, not $504,000. Some numbers got transposed.
Wait a minute. Go back to that.
Okay, Master Mates and Pilots, where it says FY 2015 would be $504,000, the value of the 1%.
Yeah.
It is actually $166,000.
Right. And Senator Dinleavy, are you able to hear us?
Yes, I am.
Please jump in anytime you have a question.
Okay, thank you.
And with the cumulative total with the number of 166 is about $1.7 million. So when you look at this cumulatively, a 1% raise adds $8 million to the cost of operating the ferry system at the end of 3 years. So it's just to put it into a little bit of a perspective. We do have the cost of living, the cold. With Inman Boat Union, that is part of that's embedded in their hourly rate, which could see an increase of $4 to $5 an hour for, again, employees whose residence is in Alaska. When you look at the Marine Engineers Association, the value of that cold that the Alaskans receive is a little over $1 million for the engineers, and the same for the master mates and pilots. And so when you look at those combined, the M&M boats, the Maritime, and the Master Mates, we pay premium to live in Alaska of almost $8 million. That is something that we want to address, because we do have geodiff studies that we recently completed, as we discussed, that we would like to see discussed at the bargaining table to see what adjustments can be made, since we have newer information than from just 1977. Now, one thing I will do this just as a pure thing. This does not reflect vacancy or turnover. There will be turnover. There will be vacancy. This is the onset of everybody today stayed in their job and was there for the full 3 years. So this is a very high representation.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. So the personnel board, the commission set up to figure out salaries for executives, the governor, commissioners, has recommended roughly a 2.5% increase this year, 2.5% increase in 2015 for executives. Do you think that sounds reasonable for the executives?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not prepared to speak on behalf of the personnel board or the state compensation board or on behalf of the governor in regard to those. One thing in my understanding, I did not attend the meetings, was what that is doing is applying the same cost of living increase that was granted during the last negotiations with the GGU, SU, and the confidential employees. That was given a 1%, 1%, 2.5%. So what that is doing is applying the 1, 1, 2.5 to commissioners. Commissioners were frozen for 3 years. When state employees received the 2%, 2, 2, and 2 in the previous contract, commissioners were frozen during that time, and they did not receive any salary increase for those 3 years. And so, but they're tied. But to my understanding from the state compensation and reading of the stuff, it's tied to what's been negotiated and which the legislature has passed, as far as commissioners are concerned.
How do we ascertain whether or not somebody qualifies as being a resident?
I'm going to give that one, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to give that one to Kate, because she's actually been in arbitration over those very issues.
Mr. Chair, we look at their primary place of abode. And so they fill out a form. They're required to fill it out every year. That lets us know whether or not their primary place of abode is in the state of Alaska. And then if there's any questions, we ask for additional information, such as utility bills, travel, that sort of thing. We have, you sign it off as if you, you test that it's all true and correct. We do line it up and compare it to if you receive a permanent fund dividend. And so sometimes if they don't match, we'll do further investigation. But very rarely do we have any questions, and it is based on where you live, where your permanent primary residence is.
Thank you.
With monetary terms of the contract, this is merely for informational purposes. But one thing that we look at is when we look at, and this is especially the Maritime and IBU, and that is what has been the consumer price index increase, which we do not bargain against. We don't use that as necessarily our methodology. But to kind of see where that has been in the last few years, and during this snapshot of time, it was 24%. During that same time, the Marine Master Mason pilots and engineers received a 31% increase in their COLAs. And plus, there was a lump sum that had been negotiated in lieu of a salary increase of $2,300. IBW, very similar. They actually got 33% during that same time, and they also had the lump sum that same year. It was a little bit less than the Master Mates and the Marine Engineers, but at 21.37. When you compare that against GGU, which is our largest union, and again, generally the supervisor's unit, confidential, 11,000 employees usually follow into that GGU column because we negotiated in that same year. They received in COLA a 19.5% increase. One thing due to note is that in the last 3 years, mastermates and pilots and engineers did not have a cost of living increase. They actually were flat at 0.00. Where they actually had that earlier is earlier in their contracting period, where GGU in 2004 had no increase, and Mastermates and MEVA and IBW got a 7% raise. Again, those were negotiated contracts at the time in different cycles. But the bottom line shows that the state has been fairly generous with cost of living increases, well above CPI, and in some cases different from our GGU friends.
The CPI, is that national or state?
We use a state CPI.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, excuse me, Mr. Chair, it's Anchorage-based CPI. One thing that I will mention here is the one thing that is not on the table when you see GGU is merit increases. They do have a salary step built in for merit increases, which is basically longevity. They get a certain percentage over 2 years. That's not actually built into that 9.5. We strictly looked at cost of living, and that's what we bargained. The maritime bargained strictly cost of living, so that's how we reflected that in this argument. But again, it's just strictly for illustration of kind of where we stand from a historical perspective. The next slide is leave accrual compared. I learned an awful lot about leave accrual last year when we were negotiating with our other unions. But leave accrual with the maritime unions, I'm going to leave for Kate to explain because there is it. I'm just leaving it for Kate to explain. You'll see why shortly.
Thank you. This chart looks a little bit busy, and I apologize for that. But there's different types of leave that's accrued by the Marine units and other state employees. So you'll see IBU accrues both annual and sick leave, as does MMMP. There are only unions right now that have both annual and sick. Everybody else has been converted to personal leave. You'll also see that they accrue A days, and I'll explain what A days are in a minute. MEVA does have personal, and they also have A days. MMMP has annual and sick. They do not have A days. They bargained that out of their contract in 2000, but they do receive a lump sum payment in lieu of the A days. And A days are basically, for MEBA, if you work a day, you earn a day of leave. And this is in the Southwest system where they're on a one crew system. So basically, a marine engineer could work 6 months straight with no time off, and then they go on leave and they use their A days. So they don't have regular days off like other state employees, like my Saturday and Sunday. The Southeast system, they generally work 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. So they're 2 weeks on, they get paid. They're 2 weeks off are their regular days off. So then they use their personal leave on their time off. Now, IBU, they accrue A days, but they have a maximum limit that they can accrue. For MEBA, it's unlimited, so they could basically be in pay status 365 days a year. Another thing about MEBA that's unique with A days is the Kennecott is actually a two-crew system, so they trade out, yet they still accrue A days. So a MEBA engineer on the Kennecott works 28 days and then accrues 28 days of A days. And then so the 28 days that would be their regular days off are actually paid. It's paid leave. And this holds true for the temporary employees. MEBA has a hiring hall. When we don't have enough engineers, they send us engineers from down south from their Seattle hiring hall, and they too accrue these A days. I do want to point out that we added ACOA as the last kind of column on this chart, and we did that because they're somewhat comparable to the Marine units. The majority of them work 7 days on, 7 days off, and so they get paid for 7 days, and their regular days off are the following week. And we wanted to highlight their leave accrual as well. Just it's not an apples to apples necessarily, but as close as we can get to other state employees.
I'm sorry. Would you run back over the folks that get paid for the days they work and the pay they don't work?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So that's A days, and it's mostly MEBA, but it can be IBU too. But it's in the Southwest system where there's one crew, and so they work until they're ready to get off the vessel. So every day they work, they earn a day of leave, which we call an A day. And then that's what they use when they're not on the vessel. But they're getting paid for it. It's not like a regular day off like the rest of us would have because they're getting paid for it. So potentially, if they've worked enough days and accrued enough A days, they can get paid for 365 days a year.
And the total salary is still that $70,000-$80,000.
Yes, Mr. Chair, correct.
Yes, thank you.
Now, do you understand why she explained it? Is there any questions with leave? Our next slide is the top three earners. What we wanted to do here, as we've done in previous presentations last year, is to look at the three four major bargaining units here, and who are the highestly who are the highest compensated employees, and determine why. Obviously, we have master mates. The master is the captain of the vessel, has a role, responsibility, and authority for all shipboard activities, safe navigation of the vessel, and is the management representative of the Alaska Marine Highway System. So our three masters, regular pay, roughly $120,000, $111,000, $130,000, but when you look at premium pay and other pay that they have, they are some of the highestly compensated state employees. And then when you have the next one down, chief engineers are the head of the engine department and are in charge of all engineering aspects aboard a vessel. They are responsible to the master of the vessel for the efficient operation of all machinery, pollution prevention, engine room sources. They are responsible to the master of the Marine Highway System for the administration, supervision, and safe operations of all the machinery and equipment aboard the vessel. And also in that, we have the first assistant who assumes the duties of the chief engineer in the event of his or her absence, and they are also responsible for the same duties as the chief engineer. Here, the chief engineer happens to be the highest, one chief engineer happens to be the highest compensated. He has a high base salary, but when you throw in premium and other pay, he's pushing $184,000. The M and Boatman unions, what we have when we say PS WIC, it's the passenger service in charge. Leads the vessel passenger service workers, providing food and beverages, passenger assistance, cleaning the vessel on board. These are for the marine highway, the high-speed craft, the fair weather that runs in southeast Alaska, and the other vessel is Chinooka. And then when we talk about able-bodied seamen, they stand navigational watch, responsible for licensed deck officer on watch during off and unloading activities, and then they're responsible for the boatswain, who is in charge of deck crew, responsible for making sure the members of the deck crew perform duties in a proper and safe manner. So when you look at that, that kind of gives you a spectrum of those. When we look at the PESEA, we do have a state trooper. In Dutch Harbor, his regular base pay is $191,000. He does have premium and other pay, and his total compensation is $202,000. The other two sergeants, again, regular pay, very highly compensated. Premium pay puts them at the $200,000 and the $195,000. Both of those troopers are located in Kotzebue and Bethel, and what drives their particular salaries is the geodiff for the cost of living in those areas, and then when you put the overtime on top of that. But we just want to kind of give you an idea of where we're at when we looked at this. This is very similar to a previous slide when we had talked about salaries of the other three bargaining units last year. So we just want to put that in perspective.
Commissioner, in the maritime industry, in general, private big boats will operate the same size vessel on one-fourth the amount of staff that the Navy does. And in that industry, there's been a great push to use modern control systems and so on and so forth to reduce the crewing requirements, largely for the operation of the vessel, not necessarily a deck crew. You know, and the railroads have gone through some of the same things since they've stopped having cabooses, you know, and so on. Is there provisions in the bargaining unit that limit management's ability to downsize crew with modern control systems, monitoring systems?
Let me just double check. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to verify, Marine Highway System staff, according to Coast Guard regulations. Now there might, you know, that's an issue with the Marine Highway System and the Coast Guard. I do know that is one of the issues when you look at running more day boats, where boats are 12 hours, they go to a destination, they come back, they're not overnight vessels, because when you do run overnight vessels, then you're running two crews, and you're running overnight crews, then you're hiring cooks and people to clean, and you have staterooms, and so it just, it drives that cost up. So day boats are more efficient. The high-speed ferries, I believe they operate on a crew of 12. Yeah, but it's a fairly small crew in comparison if you were run a full boat, a large one. One thing, too, that we just kind of look at is the health insurance for public employees. AlaskaCare, which we all enjoy. The VOTEC employees have that same health care system. MN Union of the Pacific, there are 669 members are a member of that union, as well as the Marine Engineers. As far as health trust, Master Mates and Pilots have a health trust that's not outside the state's health system. And the Public Safety Employees Association, there are 279 members, they have their own third-party administrator for their health care. The state pays a percentage of, not a percentage, but we pay I'm trying to think of the exact term. Yeah, employer contribution to that for them to maintain the health insurance.
Is there, what's the difference between the employer's contribution between AlaskaCare and the health trust?
Mr. Chairman, we negotiate what we pay, but it's usually the same benefit credit that we pay that is cost for our employees. Our employees, I think this year, is roughly $1,380. And so we generally, last year, in those negotiations, GGU has a health trust, and we pay them $1,300, the same that we cost ours. Yep. That's what we give as a benefit credit, and they get their own insurance.
Yep. Thank you. Good answer.
One issue here, and this goes to an issue that we had last year, and that's the growing leave liability. Not much has changed. It's just what we have for leave that employees carry on the books is pushing $170 million if they all cashed it out. In last year's negotiation and with the legislation that you passed, we capped that for the majority of our unions at 1,000 hours. We increased mandatory usage, and we actually lowered how much new employees receive as far as leave. So we did some items to right that ship, so to speak. The Maritime Union, as we previously discussed, they have capped hours. So that's not really an issue for negotiation. But one thing area, and just to be straight and upright, we are looking when we negotiate with the public safety employees to put the same type of bargaining that we had with last year that we successfully negotiated. That's what we're going to put on the table this year. A cap of 1,000 hours, a reduction in the merit increase, our merit steps, the reduction for new hires. Those are things we want to talk about. I think we're going to be very, we're being very transparent. We did it to 12,000 employees last year, and that's the same thing as we go into this negotiation. We're going to be talking with the Public Safety Employees Union.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Is there any issue with the Public Safety Employees where they're denied leave because of short staffing?
Through the chair, there are issues. Those are items, obviously, we need to discuss at the bargaining table. But we did take provisions in for the other unions where if leave was denied, they could hold that over. So the mandatory usage, for example, was not something that they worked against. They could be waived for a period of time. The other case that we did if you had 1,000 hours or more, then you were grandfathered in. So if you did have those extra hours, we didn't take any hours away. And where we want people to start managing them is we did a threshold of about 400 hours, and that allows the employees' time as their leave grows to start managing that for mandatory usage, again, of 2 weeks. State employees earn somewhere between 4 to 7 weeks a year. So that increase isn't dramatic, but it is something that we wanted to look at and we'll be discussing. And actually, the next slide here leads a little bit more into it. And this is where we talk about the volume of the cost. There's one thing that we as a state don't do a good job of is when we have employees with a value of leave on the books, 10 employees of close to $1.7 million, and we have some employees that have 240,000 hours, we need to do a better job of educating them that it's better for them to cash that out and to put that in deferred comp tax-free than walk out on retirement with a $240,000 check and have the IRS take a majority of it. So we need to do a little bit help better with retirement planning. Because, again, this particular person in this case at $240,000, they're still earning the maximum hours right now. So they're still gaining. And just trying to defer part of that would take them almost 6 to 8 years. And they're still earning leave. So it's just a concern of ours as far as the leave.
Senator Wilkos. Thank you. Under the Public Safety Employees Association contract, is there provisions in that contract that if they can't return to work within a certain period of time that they lose their jobs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, are you referring to the injury leave, the administrative leave provision?
Is there any provisions in their contract that if they're hurt on the job, they can't return within a certain period of time, they lose their jobs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, there's a provision called, it's referred to either as administrative leave or injury leave. And what it does is guarantee them a year's worth of pay, their base pay, in order for them to recover. And this, once the year is up, if they've exhausted all their FEMLA and their AFLA, their family medical leave, and Alaska family leave entitlements, then they could be separated, which is standard for all state employees, that you could be separated once your entitlements are over.
I'm sure when you're negotiating, you're going to take into consideration that these are people who are involved in very dangerous jobs, and if they get hurt, their career is potentially over. And I think that's one of the reasons probably a lot of the correction officers, a lot of the public safety officers, the troopers, that's probably a reason they bank a lot of their leave, and that's probably something they value a lot because if they're out of work for a year, even with a work-related injury, they can be fired. And so I just hope you'll take that into consideration as you're negotiating these contracts.
To the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we understand your point. It is something we take into consideration. And I think that if you were to look at the state of Alaska as a whole and how we treat our employees, we're probably the most generous employer in the state, especially among the private sector, of how generous we are with our employees and how we work with the unions when their members have issues or difficulties. We have extended every benefit we could to them to expand it. Even that means keeping them on pay for a day so they can get a month worth of health insurance. We're very generous in that way, and we will continue to do that. So, again, with this particular slide, it was just to show our leave liability. In here, though, we just have one member of the public safety employees that have the 3,100 hours. Everybody else is in GGU, confidential, and supervisory, and all that were negotiated. And so basically this leave liability, these people were capped with the leave that they have as far as having, you know, the 1,000 hours. But when they fall below 1,000 hours, then all the caps and mandatory usage applies to them. One thing, and this goes back a little bit to the Marine unions, as we discussed earlier, we looked to Washington State because that's the closest thing we have to a ferry system to compare. We've looked a little bit with Illinois. Obviously, they have some around Chicago on that, a little bit in the New York system, but especially here to our neighbor, Washington State. We looked at their for fiscally feasible agreements, limit the amount of overtime percentage. Again, this is Washington State. If they limit the amount of overtime as a percentage of straight time with a goal of 5% or less, removing masters or captains from the union that represents other crew on the ferries to increase management presence on the ferry with the goal of increasing the accountability and responsibility. Again, this is the direction that Washington went with, not necessarily something that we would be presenting. Reduce the amount of travel time paid. We've already addressed that as a concern for us. They saw it as an issue for them. That is something where we do think that we can have. And then align the benefits with other state employees. And that's something we've been trying to do when we started negotiating last year as we go forward, and that's aligning those benefits. And that's why we're being very transparent with the public safety union, and they have representatives in the audience. What we talk about today is what we're going to present, which is what they saw in the contracts of last year. So we want to be very transparent in that process.
I think Commissioner will take a brief at ease here and reconvene within 10 minutes, and we're doing fine on time. And so take a break here.
All right.
Works with me and his staffing the committee, and always does a better job than I expect, or even know is capable or could be done. So, Joshua, would you see if Senator Olson is in his office, please? Please continue, Commissioner.
Thank you. For the record, I do want to make one correction of a previous statement I made. And you had asked a question about the working conditions, terms of working conditions. My mind was in one place, and I do want to be for the record that there are some wages, hours, terms, and conditions that we do negotiate at the bargaining table. Those are primarily with the Public Safety Employees Association. My mind happened to be with some with our GGU and supervisory unit members on their working conditions as we go through space standards. So I just want to make that clarification that we do negotiate those with the Public Safety Employees Union.
Yeah, so, and thanks for bringing it back up. I thought it would deal with living and safety conditions, and I was thinking particularly the Marine Highway System, you know, and perhaps public safety officers in remote locations and temporary housing, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you're correct. My mind was somewhere else with a recent action that we're in arbitration with, and so I just want to make that clarification.
Yeah.
That yes, in some conditions we do negotiate those.
I'll call you back. Mr. Fair, do grievances about safety or living conditions often become part of the bargaining process?
I'm going to let Kate ask that question because she handles arbitrations for us for the department.
Mr. Chair, yes, they can be. Grievances are by definition a violation of the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay.
And so there has to be something in the collective bargaining agreement that they're grieving. There is a right to file a complaint, and that would be on something that is not in the collective bargaining agreement. And certainly when complaints are filed, there's a long process that we go through. It results in a hearing. And some of those things we do bring them up at the bargaining table. There are mandatory subjects we need to bargain, which Curtis just mentioned, which were wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. But we also can bargain permissive subjects and sometimes do bargain those into the collective bargaining agreement.
So is it fair to infer from what you just said that the arbitrator rules in favor of the grievance or complaint, you know, that's legitimate, that it would automatically become a part of the next bargaining unit agreement?
Well, Mr. Chair, possibly. The interpretation then, if we interpreted, say, contract interpretation case, we interpreted the contract, the collective bargaining agreement, in one way. The union interpreted it in another way. We go to arbitration. The state is not successful. Then, yes, the union's interpretation would be the correct interpretation of the contract based on the arbitrator's ruling. If we wanted a different interpretation to apply, we would need to bargain that change.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful.
As we go forward here, we kind of look at our bargaining priorities and concerns. When we look at the Marine Highway units, our primary focus will be fiscally prudent cost of living increases or decreases. Provide increased operational flexibility to the vessels that we've discussed. Address the conflict of interest on board vessels between masters and fellow union employees. And this is, again, where you have the master who is a union member, and everybody on the vessel is a union member, and just helping distinguish that. Another one is the, we didn't talk about it, but the elimination of past privileges for dependents and family members. If you're a Marine Highway employee, your dependents and family members get free passes to ride the Marine Highway system. It is something that is not a benefit afforded other state employees, and it is something that we want to address with them. It just seems to be an odd benefit to be in a union contract. And again, when that is something that we hope to address with them. To limit or eliminate cash draws on vessels. This was an interesting thing that came up. We have on all of our vessels, we have pursers that literally carry tens of thousands of dollars on board the vessel, because there is a provision that allows employees to be able to get cash advances on their salary, up to half their salary, during a sailing of a vessel. Now, when we've looked at that, we've looked at it, we had Department of Law look at it, and it's an old federal law that dates back to when ships are going between countries and everything since then. And the interesting thing, Canada is exempt from it, yet we have this built into our system, and clearly it was also put into place before we had ATMs, which we have at every port and at every station, and sometimes on the vessel themselves. So that isn't something that we tend to look at, is because we literally, we have people with responsibility of tens of thousands of dollars when they don't have to. Security issues for it, handling it, just administratively, we believe it's unnecessary.
Well, it is a part of an old maritime tradition of sailors being able to draw money for debauchery during your time in port, and I suspect that's not an issue for you all.
Yeah, we would hope not, Mr. Chair. And again, it's something that we looked at when we sat down and looked at these contracts. We just pulled everything, put it out there, and interestingly enough, said, well, it's a federal law. We have to do it. It's old maritime. Well, then we asked the question of law, and they're going, no, you never had to. Yet it's been out there for years and years and years. We also want to obviously to obtain voluntary and very balanced agreements for all parties. If a strike does occur, we want to continue to provide essential services to the citizens, and clarify limitations of the right to strike or the right to cross a picket line, which is obviously a topic of any negotiations.
And on that one, sir, I raised this question with the administration here a few months ago, and certainly our colleagues in Southeast represent a constituency that virtually sees the Marine Highway System as an essential part of infrastructure, if you will, and probably not as essential as they represent, but for lots of things, not just passengers, but medical emergencies, freight on the highway system carries quite a bit and so on. They're fairly passionate about not losing that. I see in the bullet here you're paying attention to that, to be able to continue to provide services. Can you come to an agreement that doesn't take the essential crew members from a Category 2 to a Category 3, that where strikes are forbidden?
Mr. Chair, they are in Category 2, or Strike Provision 2 class. We have consulted with the Department of Law on that, and it is our belief that they do have the right to strike. We also, due to life safety, their provisions in statute, have the ability to file an injunction to force them back to work while we would continue doing negotiations.
Or arbitration.
Or arbitration, precisely. It is not, we by no means are looking to have a strike. We clearly want to settle this and have this before you by the 18th of March for your consideration. But we have looked at contingencies, so we have a better understanding on the what-if scenarios if we go down there. And quite frankly, we did the same type of pre-planning last year when we did, when we negotiated with the three unions last year, looking at strike plans, updating them and that, just for preparation, put them on the shelf, and hopefully they never be used. But we need to have some of those basic understandings.
Thank you.
With the public safety employees, we've discussed it as I've gone through the presentation, but you know, again, fiscally prudent cost of living increases, reduce the cost of longevity sets, i.e. pay increments, the same provisions that have already been negotiated with other unions, reduce the legacy cost of leave liability, we all understand that cost, provide increased operational flexibility, and obtain voluntary balanced agreements and prevail on interest arbitration if we cannot agree, if we cannot, agreement cannot be reached. They cannot strike, we would have to go into interest arbitration. But again, I would especially say with the Public Safety Employees Association, if they are to look to see what we negotiated last year, they're going to find no surprises going into this year of what our goals and objectives are. And I would hope that that would be a fairly quick process. I don't know if Jake's smiling in the back or shaking his head yes, but he agrees with that. But on that particular one, I think we're going to be pretty straightforward. With the Alaska Vocational Technical Center, they have, you know, 41 employees, a couple of things. We still have the fiscally prudent cost of living increases, revised yearly steps to increase to be consistent with reducing the cost of longevity steps. They're out of the norm of other state employees, so again, we want to try to be more universal in our contracts. Again, obtain voluntary balanced agreements. We want to review the leave benefits with them. Again, it's a little different than other state employees, and do some redefining of some layoff language, again, to be more in line with other employees. If I was a betting man, this is going to be the fastest and the easiest contract to work, because I think a lot of this is tweaking a contract that we find successful with 41 employees.
Commissioner, when you showed us the slide with the salaries, I was slightly surprised at how well paid the AvTech folks are, not necessarily by themselves, but in comparison to other categories. Would you comment on that, please?
Kate will be negotiating that issue, but a lot of it is, in essence, a community college. They are adjunct professors in nature, and their salaries reflect that, but you might be able to add.
Yes, Mr. Chair, they have a different salary schedule than other state employees have. It's similar to teachers. And so what step and what range they're placed at depends on their education level, their experience. And so you'll see that some of the classes they teach the vocation, Marines, for instance, they're highly compensated in the field. And so they come in, they usually have higher experience or education, and they get placed higher on the salary schedule, as you would see typical for a teacher.
Thank you.
In conclusion, really the next steps, once the Department of Administration submits the monetary terms of the agreement to the legislature, the legislature will ultimately decide whether to fund monetary terms within the collective bargaining. The monetary terms of the collective bargaining agreement are subject by funding by your body. If the legislature fails to fund the monetary terms of the agreement, the next steps may vary by bargaining unit and may be affected by whether a tentative agreement was reached in significant time to permit us to go back to the table, negotiate, and bring back something before the legislature adjourns. And for some, an impasse is considered to exist, and for others, parties have 10 days to reach an agreement. It depends on the type of agreement. However, each situation must be evaluated differently and to the facts there. The fact that monetary terms of the parties' agreement might be submitted to the legislature after the 60th day of the session does not prevent the legislature from either considering or funding them. So if we come in on the 61st day, you may still consider them. It's up to you. Our goal is by statute to have them to you by the 60th day, so you have the full 30 days. The appropriation is subject to ratification of the collective bargaining agreement by the union's membership. If a union fails to ratify the agreement, then the funding is reduced proportionally. So even after we reach an agreement, the legislature, say, approves it, it still has to go out ratification for their members, and they can turn it down. So, and then we'll be back at the bargaining table, and that monitor, and that, again, the monetary terms will be reduced proportionally to what part was rejected or what not agreed to. And with that, we're open to, I think, most any questions that you might have in relation to personnel or labor relations.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I've heard, I haven't seen it, but I've heard there's been some requests for an outside counsel to assist in the negotiations. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, we have had on contract a law firm, which the legislature approved funding for last session for 3 years. It's I think it's $50,000 a year to help us. And where primarily they have helped us with is looking at trends of other states. We have a pretty much, we know what's happening in, so to speak, in our wheelhouse. But clearly when we look at Washington State or other states, we do have relied on the firm to help us, give us a little bit of guidance and history on that, because we have a very limited staff and it's a small contract. But yes, we have had them. We used them last year and we have funding for them for the next 3 years.
Would it be possible to get a copy of that? Was that through an RFP process? I'd like to get some more information on who they are. And I mean, it seems like we've got a huge number of attorneys working for the Department of Law and in the Labor Department, and it kind of surprises me we'd go outside of Alaska even to hire some outside firm to do this.
Well, through the chair, we did put an RFP. There was no law firms in Alaska that stepped forward with the proposal that was successful. We have used the Department of Law. Clearly, this attorney does not necessarily has never sat at the bargaining table with us. But we have, and we're set across attorneys with other bargaining units that are from out of state. Matter of fact, the lead attorney for one of the Maritimes are from Oregon. And so trying to get a perspective of what Oregon and Washington and some of those issues are. But yeah, we can easily clearly provide you that information.
And then also, if I can, so who, what's the name of this firm and what's their hourly billing rate, if I could ask? And
yeah, through the chair, I'm not sure on their hourly billing rate. It's Clark, Baird, and Smith, attorneys at law. And they primarily work for local government and management of it. They do a lot with, again, local governments throughout on the side of management to help guide and provide information for them. And matter of fact, the primary is Jim Baird, and he was up in Juneau and walked the halls and talked to legislators last year in helping understand the process and some of the things that, some of the challenges that we have.
I must have been out when it came to my office. Where are they located?
I will get you, let me see here. Rosemont, Illinois, or through the chair, Rosemont, Illinois. Right outside Chicago.
Senator Dunleavy, do you have questions? Commissioner, it has been represented to me, and not necessarily by your department, that for public employee bargaining units, the arbitration process often doesn't work well for the employer. Would you comment?
Let me take a stab at this question. Mr. Chair, I will say I think with any arbitration outcome, there is frustration on either parties. Somebody's going to win something, somebody's going to lose something, and very rarely is the baby split. There are some issues and some areas of concern that we have that I think that we will continue to have in regards to some arbitrator's decision. There are some that we find completely appalling. You know, case in point, I'll bring one up. That actually right now is pending before the Alaska Supreme Court. There was a state trooper who arrested a husband of a domestic violence on a domestic violence charge. That same trooper went back a few hours later while the husband was in jail and had sex with his wife with their minor children in the house. The trooper was dismissed, but was put back to work with 3-day suspension by an arbitrator. He had to make pay. We had to make pay his wages, and that currently is pending before the Alaska State Supreme Court. There's just some things that just kind of fly in the face of common understanding. I think Kate can address a couple of other issues with it, and I'll just let Kate.
Thank you, Curtis. Through the chair, I think as Curtis explained, you know, both sides are on winning and losing ends, and certainly the unions have voiced frustration when they've lost arbitrations as well. And in fact, AFCA is currently appealing an arbitration award that they won, but they didn't like the remedy. So it does go both ways. I think another example of a case was a juvenile justice officer who had one of the youth in their custody in handcuffs, and he was spit upon by the youth, and he ended up punching the youth in the face, and we dismissed him, and he was put back to work as well. And so those are sometimes, you know, harder to swallow. We have some where management is frustrated with what they believe is the erosion of management rights. A recent example of that is an arbitration involving correctional officers and moving to a new schedule from 84 hours to 42 hours. And I can provide more examples of different types of ones.
Well, through the chair, on the correctional officer one, with the moving from the schedule, that arbitration award would cost the state somewhere upwards to $14 million.
Annually.
And our question here is, who has the power of appropriation, an arbitrator or the legislature? It's one thing to arbitrate and figure out what the solution is, but an arbitrator from out of state negotiating and then their remedy cost the state millions of dollars, it's a concern for us. And that is something that we're currently appealing through the judicial system. And then, you know, we'll have a better understanding of it. But clearly, we're not in a place to come before the legislature and ask for this appropriation until such time that we exhaust our management rights for the remedy, since we disagree with it due to the price tag of it.
Is there another model of arbitration in North America that seems to work? It's still fair, but works better.
Mr. Chair, there's various methods that states have incorporated. I believe Anchorage Police Department has a clause in their collective bargaining agreement where for discipline grievances it goes to a committee made up of 3 people, and I believe it's made up of management and labor. So there are different things that different states use. Through the Public Employment Relations Act, PARA, we are required to have binding arbitration.
Yeah, I realize that. Do you, under present statutes, do you have the freedom to move to a system like the APD has here?
Through the chair, we would need to bargain that. Within the collective bargaining agreements is where we have the arbitration.
So you do have within that limitation. In other words, we don't need to change the statutes in order to give you that option?
The statute requires the binding arbitration. Statute could require something different, certainly, and we would be bound to follow the statute.
Yeah, but that was under the binding arbitration, would you be able to move under existing statute to a committee system like you just said that Anchorage Police Department uses?
Through the chair, I would want to do some further legal research on that before I give you a final answer, if you will. But there is stuff in the collective bargaining agreement that we could bargain.
Okay, and I think I speak for my colleagues that we're cheerfully willing, wanting to be helpful. That doesn't mean we're going to be your lapdogs and do what the administration says, but I appreciate that. So, the years I worked on the slope supervising a lot of employees, I got some amazing grievances. We had Arctic entries on most of the buildings, and they blew a curtain of air down, and guys with hairstyles like mine who were doing comb-overs took significant exception to what the air currents did. Also had a grievance on the texture of toilet paper, which we had to deal with. And I understand you all have had some interesting ones as well. I'm not meaning to demagogue the system, but give me some examples.
Mr. Chair, we've had them over the type of potato chips that are served on our marine highway vessels. We are currently in the process over day boats. Again, they start at a destination, they go, they come back. We have them where meals and coffee are not provided. They are, there's an arbitration over lattes, free lattes. Now, state employees go to work, they come home, they take a lunch, they bring a lunch, that's a day boat. That's a state employee's work day. And we're in arbitration over whether the fact that they get, the state pays their meals, where we don't do it for other state employees. So those are some of them. I'm saying some are some that you kind of look at and you kind of think there has to be a way to work through this. And others, you know, there's merits on both sides. And you look at an arbitration and you clearly see that you see one, you see this point of view, you see that point of view, and clearly, you know, you one would hope there's some middle ground. But we do have some of those extreme ones too. That it takes time and money away from other ones. I know that we're we have an arbitration that was asked for about three months ago, and it won't be resolved. We won't get it before an arbitrator until May, because we have so many other things backed up, and it just takes time and money on all parties. So it is kind of frustrating in that regard.
I served an apprenticeship here on the Anchorage Assembly, which was enlightening. But I remember then we were dealing with uniforms for police officers. That can be legitimate. But we had in the bargaining agreement included underwear, you know, and that got to be interesting and so on. And certainly a part of it was whether or not there was a plug-in for, you know, for cars and so on. You can argue, certainly in Fairbanks, probably not so necessary here, but took up a huge amount of time and was indeed a part of the bargaining units, the bargaining agreements. And because we have the time, I'm going to, I see we have three leaders of bargaining units here, and I'm going to give you a chance to talk a little bit about internally what goes on with grievances and compliances. A couple other things. I was going to ask about, one of the conversations I've had with somebody in your house that was an arbitration that was forcing the state to pay for employees on time not actually worked. I don't even know if I got the question right. What's going on?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, there are times when the state is not successful in arbitration and we may have to pay for time not worked. The most obvious one is if an employee's been dismissed and then they're put back to work. Generally, not always, but it requires make whole wages. But there are instances, and one I can think of off the top of my head is with correctional officers. Under their collective bargaining agreement, in order to get overtime, they sign up for what they call a work assignment contact list, which is basically your name and phone number, and you sign up in order and you get called in order. Right, and it's just a way to call in people in order for overtime, so it's equally distributed. If for some reason that person gets skipped over and they don't get called, the remedy that an arbitrator has awarded is that they get paid the overtime. So if it was a 12-hour overtime assignment, they would get 12 hours of overtime pay, even though they didn't work the 12 hours and somebody else did. So the state ends up paying double the overtime.
That seems unreasonable. What's the remedy?
Mr. Chair, that was the remedy imposed by the arbitrator. And so we were unsuccessful in bargaining a different remedy when that occurs. And so currently that is still the practice.
So back to an earlier conversation, I asked, do arbitrator decisions end up being the default for the next contract? And if I understood what you said, then that means you're stuck with it and you can't bargain that back or away that decision in the next contract.
Mr. Chair, we certainly could try to bargain it away and did try to bargain it away, but weren't successful. As you know, with bargaining, it's a give and take. And so unless there's different language bargained into the agreement, the arbitration's the arbitrator's interpretation remains.
All right. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sayed, you mentioned that arbitration, you have a backlog and it's time and money. Do you have a sense of how much the state spends annually on arbitration dollars? Dollar-wise?
I'm going to let, through the chair, I'm going to let Kate answer that or because she's responsible for our labor relations for the state and arbitrations.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, we schedule probably 2 to 3 arbitrations a month. We don't go on all of them. It's just like a trial. Most of them don't end up going and they settle. So we do have some costs that are related to cancellation costs. But if we do go to arbitration, and arbitrator's fees are, I would say, at a minimum $10,000. We've paid as much as $25,000 for just a contract, not even an interest arbitration, but a regular, contract interpretation dispute. And so I'd have to check to see how much we spent. I believe in 2013, calendar year 2013, we've gone on, I think, 12 or 14 arbitrations, and we've won about half and lost about half. Generally, all the collective bargaining agreements have a lose or pays provision, and so unless the arbitrator splits the baby, one side pays all the expenses, and of course, then we have our own expenses for our own travel and costs.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. How many state employees fall under collective bargaining agreements?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I believe it's around 15,000, maybe a little bit higher than that.
A couple follow-ups, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so 15,000 employees. If I heard you, you're doing 12 to 14 arbitrations a year, and the maximum cost is about $25,000 per arbitration, which seems very high to me. But so 12, and you're winning about half, losing about half, so you're paying about 6 times $25,000, assuming the maximum cost. So you're paying about $150,000 in arbitration costs. Is that about right for 15,000 employees?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not sure that could be accurate. 25 is definitely the higher scale. I will say most arbitrators now are charging about $1,800 a day.
Continue.
Okay. And so who are the arbitrators that you use?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we have a panel of arbitrators that's agreed to between the union and the state. Generally, we request a list of 25 names from the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Services, FMCS, out of Seattle. And from that 25 names, the union and the state together strike who they don't want. So you're left with either 7 or 11, depending on the collective bargaining agreement.
And so I know, how long do your arbitrations typically take? 1 day, 2 days, 10 days?
Through the chair, 2 to 3 would be standard. If it's a very complex case, it could take up to 5 days. If it's something like a letter of warning, it could take a day. And then there's also, like I said, there's the arbitration cost, but there's also our own travel costs per diem that we have to pay our staff. That's not counted as that cost you just mentioned.
So if you do and 2 days for a warning, seems extremely long to me. As someone who does arbitrations and has done probably a couple hundred and has maybe had two that have gone 2 days. So 2 days, $1,800 a day, is $3,600. And maybe it takes the arbitrator 2 days to write a decision at the most. So that's another $3,600. So that's $7,200. Travel costs, hotel, maybe $150. Having a hard time seeing how you get to an average of $25,000 per arbitration.
Well, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, first of all, I agree 2 days for a letter of warning does seem excessive, but unfortunately there's two parties at the arbitration and not just the state. And they get paid for the full days. Of course, they also charge us, the arbitrators charge us for their travel costs, their meals, their hotels. Honestly, they charge us for pretty much everything that they do, actual costs. And so that does raise it. And, of course, we can't control how long it takes them to write the award.
Mr. Chair, maybe for the sake of clarification, could we get the arbitrations that you've had for the last few years along with the win-loss ratio and the total costs associated with that so we could get a better idea?
Yes, we have those records.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions for our administration? Any questions, Mr. Dunleavy?
No. Thank you.
All right. So, not on our schedule, but I want to give this three members, at least of the bargaining units here, all three happen to be old acquaintances, and so I'm going to give you a chance for a little bit of input here. Thank you very much to both of you. It was well done and very useful information, sometimes surprising.
Thank you very much for your time and for inviting us this morning.
Like you, it's part of our job. Come on up. Hey, Jake. Okay, come on, sit down and identify yourself for the record. I don't want to turn this into a debate, but you've been around for a long, long time, both of you, and I want to give you a chance to give us a bit of additional information you think that we need in order to understand this process. And both of you, identify yourself for the record.
I'll start. Faith Putman, representing ASCA, Alaska State Employees Association, the GGU that was brought up in your PowerPoint. We finished our negotiations, thank you very much, funded last year by the legislature. So nothing in particular. We're just here to observe the presentation by the administration and don't have anything particular to add. Maybe Jake does. He does have negotiations.
Okay. And great. I wasn't specifically talking about how the contract itself, but this whole concept and discussion here and so on. Anything comes to mind for you that would be helpful for us to know?
Well, you know, arbitrations are a process that allows the members of our unit to realize some relief without having to go to court. I mean, that's the process of contracting and arbitration, to avoid that process, to avoid having attorneys involved. And we think that it's successful. We have this American Arbitration Association arbitrators who are qualified from their experience to make decisions about controversies within a contract and interpretation of a contract. We think it's been a successful program. We think it works well.
Got it. Thanks.
Okay.
Jake? Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity. My name is Jake Metcalf. I'm Executive Director for the Public Safety Employees Association. We are going into contract negotiations starting next week, and Commissioner Thayer mentioned that. I would just add to what Faith said, just to give you a little history. Arbitration was created back in the early days of factories in order to solve disputes on the workplace, on the floor of factories and that sort of thing. It was set up to be a quick resolution, to avoid going to court and avoid lawyers and long drawn out disputes. And you know, we've got a process that's been in place for years. We also, as unions, have a duty of fair representation obligation. If there's been a contract violation, and a member comes and wants to dispute that, we look at it. We have a very detailed process in place, so we're not bringing forward contract disputes that aren't what we consider relevant and just. And we have a committee within our union that looks at grievances and votes on whether or not it goes forward, because it's a big expense to unions to go forward with arbitration. We don't want bad decisions made, and so we look at them very carefully before we go. One other thing that I want to point out that I don't think was pointed out in earlier testimony is we work extremely hard to resolve cases before they get to arbitration. because of the expense and the time that goes into it. We're a small union, quite a bit smaller than our fellow affiliate, ASCA. And so it's to our benefit to solve things. We oftentimes run into just absolutely no interest in solving cases. And so we're left with going to arbitration, which we don't want to. You know, we're also finding that arbitrations don't get done quickly. We see that there's a lot of turnover in staff at the state. We think it's probably because of wages and people that have the training to be labor negotiators being able to find work where they make better money somewhere else. And I think that's something that you got to look at as a legislature, is keeping good people in jobs. And without a retirement system, you're not able to do that. And we find that as a major problem for police officers in this state, is that they have no defined benefit retirement system, and they can get it in most other states. I can just add to that question that Senator Diesel had about... I think it was Soldotna Police Department. We represent Soldotna Police Department. They don't have a retirement system. And a lot of these local police departments are not able to get people because they don't pay retirement. And if you can go somewhere else and get a 20-year retirement system, that's a pretty good deal. And with police officers who carry 60-pound belts, get shot at, and are often breaking up domestic violence situations, it's a career that, you know, you can't chase bad guys when you're 50 years old.
Thank you. Any questions, committee members? Senator Olson?
Actually, I do have one, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for coming up this morning. One of the problems that I've always had with this reinstatement of employees that have done egregious acts, for example, the one where he arrested somebody, went back to the house and had an affair with the wife there, and then the union steps in and vigorously defends the person to go back to work. I have a problem with that justification from a moral standpoint of how you go ahead and make sure due process is out there. I mean, I realize you're not in a court of law, but the conscience of a person and us as policymakers are, how do you as a union go ahead and defend some as egregious as that?
Well,
I mean, I'm not talking about that particular case. I'm talking about there are other cases out there, and we have had problems with them in the past. And one of the reasons that I've been so hard on some of the unions is that there have been people that have been, I would say, derelict in their duties, and the union stands up and defends them. And so that's where I've got a moral problem with that, with the union. I mean, is there a mentality that I'm not getting into, or that I'm not subscribing to, that allows the union to, a union that is well respected as you guys are? And I've been dealing with you guys for the last 10 or 15 years, and so I don't understand sometimes why the union steps up to go ahead and do something like that.
Well, what we look at is whether the person has been treated fairly and whether the contract has been violated. I also think that, you know, you need to look at all the facts, and I think cases are often picked out that sort of have fallacious details in them. But, you know, I can speak to the one case that Mr. Thayer talked about. That arbitrator is probably one of the most well-respected arbitrators in the country. And she looked at the facts of that case and found that that person wasn't treated fairly in the process, and that there were facts that had nothing to do with his duty or his job that were used in order to terminate him. And so she put him back to work. You know, I'm happy to provide you with the arbitrator's decision in that. We've got it, so you can look at it and see the reasoning that she used to give him his job back. And that's what the court will look at to decide whether or not that arbitrator made the right decision. You know, so we see that as a case where an arbitrator, one of the most well-respected arbitrators in the country, made a decision based on the facts about whether this person was treated fairly. And according to us and her, we didn't feel that process was conducted fairly. And so that's why I went to arbitration. That's why the arbitrator put that person back to work. And so we want people to be justly treated in the workplace. And if they're not, then we're going to stand up and defend them. They paid dues for that, right? The employer has signed a contract that in discipline situations, people are going to be treated fairly. And if they're not treated fairly, then that's the process that's set up in the contract, and that's why we have an arbitrator come in and decide that.
Senator Olson, you continue? Continue, please, Mr. Chairman. So you just stated that you wanted the people to be treated fairly in the workplace. I'm assuming the workplace, when the guy got arrested, included that house. Do you not feel that the wife and that the person that was booked into the jail was fairly treated? Besides that, the guy is not even guilty. He's not guilty until he's proven in a court of law. And so how can you, I'm not talking about specific cases. I just don't see where you only are looking at, from a biased eyes, only on one person. Sure, he pays dues. I understand that. We are policymakers, and how can we go ahead and respect some of the decisions that come out of these arbitrations? And maybe you all respect an arbitrator, but I'm assuming that arbitrator is part of the arbitration board that comes out of Seattle and probably even from the state of Alaska. So I'm still have a problem with the unions and their vigorous defense of people that have done. I mean, if somebody did that to my wife, you know, there is a as somebody put it out. There is a stand your ground law here in the state of Alaska now, and so I bring that up in a manner that, you know, I feel that's a fair that's a violation that's inexcusable.
Well, Senator, I would just ask that you read the arbitration decision and not go with sort of facts that haven't been presented to you, and you look at the decision, because I think there are other facts that you need to consider that are part of that arbitration decision, and it's not as it's been let out to be here. There are other things that you need to look at, and in the arbitration decision, you can look at that and make a decision on whether you agree with it or not. Ultimately, it'll go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will decide whether or not that arbitrator made the right decision.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify my question concerning the trooper station on the peninsula. First of all, it was state troopers who do, in fact, have a retirement. It's called defined contribution. And I spoke with that commander about why the vacancies. Of course, they have retirements because people get to retirement age. And filling those slots are a challenge because people who apply don't actually meet the requirements of the job. In addition, there's a significant barrier with the public safety training going on in Sitka, 3 months away from home. And those folks are not allowed to go home on the weekends. I mean, at least in Juneau, typically, we can leave Juneau to come home on a weekend, but they're not allowed to do that. And that creates a barrier for employment as well. So, just for clarification, I was talking about state troopers, not local police forces. Thank you.
Mr. Metcalf, I assume that in what you're saying, it wasn't the union's position that what the man did was appropriate, but indeed that the process under which was not handled according to whatever the standards are.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, a lot of times there's conduct that we don't agree with. But if it's off the job, if there are other facts in there, that's not something that has to do with work. We're concerned about work and whether or not the contract is abided by. We certainly, you know, if it's moral conduct, we're not moral judges, but there's a lot of conduct that we don't agree with. There's conduct where it's not on the job and there's conduct where it is on the job. We're concerned about what's on the job and whether the rules on the job are followed.
Yeah, I'm processing. All of us here have been members of professional associations, and there's professional board licensing sometimes and so on and so forth, and we all hope that those professional boards will watch out for bad practitioners within that profession and a discipline process, and that clearly should and often or sometimes does, you know, lose their license. I assume that it's not typical for bargaining units to have those kind of internal processes to get rid of employees who are doing unacceptable or unethical behavior?
Well, it's not typical that we get rid of people, but we certainly have an internal process that brings people in and says, we don't think this conduct is appropriate. We've had plenty of cases that we've, you know, told members, no, we're not going forward with your arbitration because the facts are, based on our review of your case, that the conduct that you engaged in hurts the profession. The conduct that you participated in as a police officer, as a state trooper, is not worthy of the position. And we have a very strong interest in making sure that our members are looked up to and are honest, and it protects our industry. We don't want bad troopers or bad police officers out there. It doesn't do anybody any good. And then there's the, you know, Alaska Police Standards Council that looks at conduct, on-the-job conduct, and even conduct off the job. And if they think it's, you know, bad enough, they'll do a process. We've asked members to surrender their license because we don't think they can prevail at the APSC level. And we've, you know, worked with them to be able to surrender their license and get on with their lives. So that, you know, it's an important issue to us to make sure our membership is doing the job right and highly thought of.
And I'm glad that you had the opportunity to clarify that, and I respect that. And I'd forgotten about the police standards. I think Senator Olson reflects a passion we all feel about the public has got to be able to trust the police and the courts. You know, that's what obviously public safety is all about. And we have a broader responsibility in a sense than just the conduct of an individual. And it's the reputation of the whole process. I used to be able to be proud to say that in our prisons, we had almost no cases of staff on prisoner violence and convict on convict rape, particularly, and all those kind of things. And the record isn't as good as it used to be for different kinds of reasons, but public safety and citizens' confidence in their government is inordinately important, and particularly with people like you represent, and I'm glad you are working on it interior. I have to reflect, share Senator Olson's passion here that a police officer that did that, even though it was on his own time and perhaps with a willing partner in it, is still, you know, it's inconceivable to me to be allowed to keep his position, but I understand your position. Senator Wilkowski had a question.
Thank you.
Comment.
On the, what are you noticing as far as recruitment and retention with public safety employees, and is that, have you noticed any impact?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I guess I'm not following your question, noticing any impact. Could you follow up on that?
Well, are you finding that people who are coming on are staying on as troopers? Are you finding that we're competitive wage-wise, benefit-wise? Are you seeing any anything noticeable from your perspective?
Let me break that down a little bit. We, just for the benefit of the committee, we have three groups that are state employees that we represent, and I don't think one was mentioned in the state's presentation. We also represent the court service officers, which are part of public safety. They're not state troopers. They're court service officers. They don't make as much money as state troopers. They have a different training system set up. They're now, some of them are being certified. They haven't been certified in the past, but they work in the courthouses around the state and are very much a part of our membership and a significant number of our membership. So we have three groups. We have the court service officers, the airport police, and the state troopers. As far as recruitment and retention, Senator Giesel mentioned that it is a difficult process. We think it's important that it be a difficult process because you want good people to go through that and be well-trained when they're out enforcing the laws. You know, what we do see is a lot of people leaving within their either their first 5 years or when they vest into the defined contribution system, and they, you know, they take their money that they've vested, which is the state's, and their own money because they both contributed. They take that and go to a place that has a defined benefit retirement system, and usually a 20 or a 25-year retirement system for police officers, because the career is physically demanding and dangerous. We see with a lot of our municipal police departments, which aren't state employees, but they're also going to systems, either the federal or other state systems, with a defined benefit retirement program. With airport police, there's a lot of turnover. They're a much younger group, and so we're concerned about that. We believe that they're going to be facing understaffed situations, which we think drives up overtime. We think the troopers are understaffed, and that overtime is a concern there. Overtime is, you know, basically a concern everywhere because people end up having to work a lot, and that has effect on their lives because they're spending a lot of time working, and then, you know, you see the numbers that people are making a lot of money. We think that's a management issue, and it's also a staffing issue, and we think that for the public safety of the state, those departments should be staffed properly.
Okay, and thank you. Senator Giesel has to leave. A couple other members here have some other commitments. Been very helpful. And Mr. Wojcicki or Senator, you can pursue a couple of other things here. I think Jake can stick around for a few minutes. Thank you all. Very informative, and we appreciate your helping to educate us. We're adjourned.